From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, as fires continue to rage in the western United States, we get some understanding about why massive wildfires are happening with more regularity.
Later, one woman's journey from working as a divorce lawyer to running a natural cleaning products company.
I think one of the other things that's most important about our brand is the transparency. I think if you always tell the truth in your packaging, you're never going to get into trouble. Your customers deserve to know what they're buying, and I think the legal profession really supports that as well.
And we meet Irish indie band Brave Giant. They have a couple of EPs out, but they prefer to play live.
Definitely live shows is what I enjoy most because you're literally feeding off that energy of a crowd, of a good crowd. There's no better buzz, I don't think, as a performer or an entertainer that you can get. It's brilliant.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. At last report yesterday, more than 21,000 firefighters are deployed around the country, mainly in the West. More than 1.5 million acres have been charred by 62 large wildfires that are currently burning.
The fire danger is comparatively low in Wisconsin, but the state isn't immune from large-scale fires either. And this time of year, wildland firefighters from the state are dispatched to places like Oregon, Montana, and California.
While fires have always burned landscapes, the regularity with which enormous fires are overspreading the West is something relatively new. And the phenomenon has roots in both the natural and human-affected worlds, as writer Michael Kotis has chronicled in his new book, Megafire. We reached him on the line from Colorado. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with a really basic point, but one that might not be appreciated by everyone. Why is fire such a key part of the natural order of things?
Well, fire is as natural to most vegetated landscapes as rain is. We don't need fire as often in most of those vegetated landscapes, but in some ways, fire is nature's gardening crew. It goes in and it removes underbrush and dead wood and things that build up in the woods. It's also critical for the survival of certain animal species. Animals like, say, the black-backed woodpecker, which are completely dependent on severely burned forests for their homes and for the insects that they eat. And it's also a very critical part of rejuvenating soils throughout both forests and grasslands. In Kansas, where I grew up, there are still ranchers from Texas and even as far away as Mexico who send their cattle up to Kansas to graze on fields that the ranchers in Kansas burn because a cow that grazes grass on a recently burned pasture can gain more than 20% more weight than it would grazing grass in an old field that hadn't burned in a number of years.
Well, so then how are the fires today that we're seeing in places like Montana and California and in Australia and Israel and elsewhere, how are they different from this normal, even beneficial fire cycle?
So we've really changed the structures of our forests. And we've changed the chemical makeup of our atmosphere, so we're raising temperatures in a lot of landscapes. And we also have moved into these landscapes, so we have a huge amount of development in vegetated landscapes, and all of those things affect the fire cycle. One thing that we did was put out wildfires for a century in the United States. We actually had a policy called the out by 10 a.m. policy for many decades, where any natural wildfire that was sighted anywhere in the country was supposed to be extinguished by 10 a.m. the next day. And in a lot of forests, that allowed a huge buildup of fuel. Some of our ponderosa pine forests, say in Arizona or New Mexico or Colorado, burned in what they called low-intensity ground fires every 10 or 20 years. And when we put out fires for a century, we interrupted the fire cycle so that some of these forests missed 5 or 6 of the natural fire cycles they would have experienced. And so all of the fuel that would have been burned away by those fires instead built up. And some of these forests now have 10 or even 20 times more fuel, more trees and brush in them than they would have naturally. So when a fire finally does get away and burn in those forests, it burns entirely differently because it's got far more fuel than it had historically in those forests.
You also mentioned development in vegetated areas. This is the place that it's referred to as the wildland-urban interface. This is not just people who want to have a house in the woods these days.
No. I mean, sometimes it's communities. You know, here in Colorado back in 2012, we saw a fire burn into the city of Colorado Springs and burn hundreds of homes inside the city limits in areas where most of the residents didn't think they had a forest fire threat at all. In fact, most of what burned were the trees that they had planted in their yards or the landscaping and materials that they'd used in building their homes. The U.S. Forest Service now estimates nearly one in three U.S. homes are in the wildland-urban interface where they risk burning in a wildfire. So there's a huge threat and cost of development in flammable areas. But it also means that we've changed the way fires start. A recent study this year showed that about 84% of the wildfires in the nation are started by humans. That's not necessarily arsons or the things that we think of, like somebody throwing a cigarette out the window of their car. You know, often it's something like a power line that goes down or sparks from a vehicle wheel when it has a blowout. In California, they've had three instances of fires being started by golfers who actually hit a rock with their golf club, and the spark from the golf club on the rock went into dry grass and started a serious wildfire. So we're not just providing new fuels in these forests and providing building homes that can be destroyed by the wildfires. We're also bringing fire into these forests.
Well, so when it comes to the policies that have kind of led to this current fire regime, are we talking mainly about the Forest Service's role here, or is this the will of the people and local governments as well?
It's both. The Forest Service is the big dog in wildfire, but they're one of several land management agencies in the federal government that are involved in fighting wildfires. The Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Indian Affairs are all involved in the fight against wildfires. But states have their own issues with wildfire. Cal Fire in California is a huge firefighting agency focused on wildfires. And then county governments, municipal governments, just your local fire protection agency. They're all involved in dealing with this and all bearing the incredible escalating costs of wildfires to the country.
Well, so if the policy in years past had been this out by 10 a.m. mentality, now today when we have one in three people living in the potential path of a wildfire in this wildland-urban interface, how do we approach fire suppression when there is so much private property in such close proximity to places that could burn?
Well, the land management agencies are really trying to focus their efforts on protecting communities that are threatened by wildfires or infrastructure that is threatened by wildfires, like, say, power lines or reservoirs, watersheds. You know, there are a lot of things threatened by wildfire that we depend on, outside of just our home. So that's one issue with it, but it also is very complicating to both the firefighting effort, going in and trying to manage a natural process and effectively a weather phenomenon, with the community there. It also makes it really difficult to prepare for wildfires with, say, forest thinning operations and prescribed burns, because these forests, many of which have a much heavier fuel load than they had naturally, so they won't burn the same way they did historically, need wildfire put back into them, or they need fire put back into them. And so we usually do that with a prescribed burn, which is basically a fire that's intentionally set by foresters and firefighters and managed by them to try to do the good work that fire used to do for that forest and bring it, into a healthier state. But when you're having to do that next to a community, they may not be happy about that. Many communities aren't happy with the smoke that they'll have to deal with when you have a prescribed burn. They don't necessarily like the idea of having a fire in their backyard and the threat that that might pose to them. And we've certainly seen instances of prescribed burns that went wrong and destroyed homes and even killed residents in nearby neighborhoods. And, you know, there's just a sense that, you know, there's a lack of trust sometimes in the people who both have to fight the fires and reintroduce fires into these forests to make them less threatening when a natural wildfire starts in them in the future.
Well, and I gather in the era of climate change, the seasons that you can employ prescribed burns are getting shorter.
They are. Holding a prescribed burn is a very complicated and difficult process now. You know, often you're talking about hundreds of personnel that need to be involved in it. And one thing that we've seen with climate change, and climate change has a huge impact on the fire cycle in the country, is that particularly here in the West, our mountains get a little bit less snow, and that snow melts off a lot earlier in the season, in the spring, than it used to. So, you know, a snow-capped peak above a forest is effectively a little trickle reservoir that keeps that forest below it moist and prevents that forest from burning explosively. Well, when that snow melts off earlier in the season, that forest is primed to burn earlier in the season, and the season in which foresters and firefighters can go in there and manage prescribed burns to kind of lower the future fire risk in that forest gets shorter and shorter and shorter, and the threats and risks of that prescribed burn increase.
I know you're right about this issue as well. When it comes to fighting wildfires today, how do we prioritize firefighter safety in comparison to saving property?
Well, all of the agencies that manage wild and firefighters are constantly trying to improve firefighter safety, both through technologies like, say, better fire shelters, these little pup tents that every firefighter is required to carry with them when they're working on a wildland fire so that they can shelter from a fire that's blowing up. And also in policies in which they, rules for how wildland firefighters engage with fires. But when you're actually on the fire line and you're dealing with these wildfires, decisions are made very quickly, and wildland firefighters are facing threats and challenges that they didn't used to face historically. A great example of this was a couple of years ago when I updated my red card, which is the card you hold to show that you're certified and trained in the United States to work as a wildland firefighter. And when I went through the updated training, there were things in the training like what to do if you're a wildland firefighter and you stumble upon a meth lab in the woods or an illegal chemical dump, or what to do if you come to a community with a home that's got a long, winding driveway with a bunch of trees overhanging it. These aren't threats that wildland firefighters ever had to think about before, and they're threats that they're neither equipped nor trained to deal with. The other thing that wildland firefighters are having to deal with increasingly is communities and homes that are threatened by fires. And that's very difficult for wildland firefighters to deal with because, you know, it's pretty easy to step back from a bunch of burning trees and say, this is too dangerous, I'm going to let these trees go. You don't have a personal relationship with those trees. It's much more difficult to do that with homes when you're a wildland firefighter and you actually are in a forest next to a community and that fire's about to start burning down homes. Much harder to step back from the fire and say this is too dangerous because you may actually even know people that live in or own those homes, or you may be familiar with that community, and so you have what firefighters call a bias toward action.
We're talking about millions of acres that are burning each year. In fact, I think you say we're getting to the point where it's very possible that something like 20 million acres could burn in a bad year. What does the future look like for those lands that are seeing this high intensity fire?
Well, we're definitely going to see a continuing of the increase in wildfire that we've had over the last several decades. In 2015, for the first time since the U.S. government kept such records, we saw 10 million acres burn, and that was seen as, you know, a huge increase, and it was. The 1970s, the average was about 3 million acres a year burning, so seeing 10 million acres burn in 1 year was pretty flabbergasting to a lot of firefighters. But Forest Service scientists around the same time came out with a study that anticipated that sometime in the next few decades, we'll start to see 20 million acres a year burn. That's an area nearly the size of the state of Maine burning in the United States in a bad fire year. That's going to be very disruptive to many aspects of our life, even if you don't live in those forests, because we're going to see much more smoke in our skies across the country. We're going to see a lot of health impacts from those fires. We're also going to see great difficulties with our budget. In 1995, about 16% of the U.S. Forest Service budget was spent on wildfire. In 2015, that year when we broke 10 million acres burning, 52% of the Forest Service budget was spent on wildfire. So if that doubles, we're looking at, you know, the majority of the Forest Service budget being spent on wildfire, as well as many other land management agencies seeing their budgets basically burned up by the wildfire problem.
Why was it important for you to renew your red card?
Well, for one thing, you know, I'm an old newspaper guy, so I like to get to as close to the front lines as I possibly can. So being able to do that, you know, required me to have a red card in certain areas, and so that was helpful. But it also helped me to understand the challenges that were you know, wildland firefighters are facing and the new challenges that they're facing in recent years. You know, one thing I write a lot about is the tragic death of the Granite Mountain Hotshots in 2013 in Arizona. And there were no survivors in this incident. There were no witnesses to what happened in the final minutes that these 19 firefighters were alive. But the one thing that was happening at that time was the town of Yarnell was being burned over by this wildfire, and these firefighters could see it from the safety zone they were in on top of a mountain. Nobody knows why they would move from the safety zone that they were in into a heavily vegetated canyon that most firefighters would recognize as a death trap, except for the fact that it was the quickest way for them to get to that town and help out. And I felt I needed to go through the training and keep my training up so that I could kind of empathize and understand the decision-making process that wildland firefighters are being forced to make now, since those decisions are far more complicated and fraught with far more risk than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Well, Michael Kotas, it's really compelling reading. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Michael Kotas's recent book is called Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. We reached him at his office in Colorado.
We'll take a short break now and then meet two of the people behind a Milwaukee-based natural cleaning products company that's turning into a national name in the industry. This is Lake Effect from WUWN.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Where once you had to go to a specialty store to find natural cleaning products, they're now on shelves in places from supermarkets to Target. And a Milwaukee-based company is ending up with products on an increasing number of shelves around the country.
Rebel Green launched its first product 9 years ago. It was a spray to wash fruits and vegetables. And in the time since, the company has added things ranging from dish soap to laundry detergent to toilet paper.
Allie Florsheim is the co-founder and co-owner of Rebel Green, and Christina Nosbisch is director of operations. There. They join us in the studio today. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
So where did this work begin? What was lacking out there that Rebel Green spoke to?
Well, thanks for asking. My business partner, Melina Marcus, and I started this business in 2008 because we noticed that nobody was using produce wash. She and I were one of the only ones we knew who were using a fruit and vegetable wash. And we thought, well, why aren't people using this? This is a great product. People should be washing their fruits and vegetables if they can. You know, you wash your hands before you eat, so if it's available and you can wash your fruits and vegetables, why not? One of the reasons that they weren't buying it is because the packaging just wasn't great. It wasn't compelling. It looked like a household cleaner. And so we know that if you want people to buy a product that's good for you, you're going to want the packaging to be really compelling. So we decided we were going to give it a try, and we started our first product, which was our Rebel Green Fruit and Veggie Clean.
Well, so let's take a step back, because I imagine there are people who are listening to this and they are saying, I already have fruit and vegetable wash. It's called my sink.
Mm-hmm.
What's the compelling reason to use something beyond water or your shirt tail?
Well, I think that's a great question. One of the things that, you know, farmers and growers of all kinds have to do is they have to spray their crops in order to resist rain. So the tap water in your kitchen sink is pretty much like rainwater. You're just not going to get that off unless you use a wash sometimes, or you peel things, or you take that extra effort to really scrub something to get it off. So when I would use a wash, I would do like grapes or strawberries, and I would look at the bottom of the bowl and I'd notice what was in there, and it's so gross. And the grossest thing, actually, is it gets darker during the course of the day. When we're at demonstrations for trade shows, we just notice it gets darker and darker, and that's just nasty. So we're really happy to have this product available.
So then take us to that next step. You came up with the idea. You found the right people to formulate it. How did you go from that point to actually getting it on a shelf in a store?
Well, we actually it's kind of funny the way it happened. We kind of, you know, waited, and we were a little, you know, shy and a little timid about getting into stores. We kind of had to find our feet. And we had our first buyer was a buyer at Whole Foods in Milwaukee, who the product was sitting on a shelf in the sample room forever. And he got to his job and he said, you know, we really should give these guys a try. They're right here in Milwaukee. At the time, we were right down working in the Blatt's building at the time. So we were really close. And if it wasn't for him, we probably would have had a much slower start. So it really taught us the credit of having local support. You know, it just expedited the process so much faster. We're always so, we know that guy, you know, 13 years later, we're super, super grateful for him. He's a terrific person. We're lucky that he gave us a chance.
So then talk about the decision-making process when it came to scaling up and doing something besides fruit and vegetable wash. Is this the point that you come in, or where do you enter the business?
I've been with the company for actually about 8 years now, I realized the other day. And
So not long after it started?
Correct, yeah. Well, with regard to the produce wash, yeah.
Sure.
And we had a lot of buyers asking, you know, well, what else do you have? What else do you have? It was a question that kept coming up, and it seemed like the natural progression. Well, what's next? And, you know, household cleaning's a big deal. Everyone does it. And people are getting more and more concerned about what they're using and the chemicals they're bringing in their home. So it just seemed logical to move in that direction.
Is there an economies of scale kind of decision at work that you can't necessarily support an entire business on one product?
That's really true. And it also, you know, that's one of the points that are, you know, it's really important. We had a great team in place of just a couple of us, and we wanted the business to grow, but we also wanted to continue our mission, which is using packaging to take the conventional shopper into the natural space without them even really noticing that they're starting to get into the natural cleaning section. So we took that same aesthetic, which is, you know, what we started with our flagship fruit and vegetable wash, and the same quality of ingredients and the same chemistry. And we decided to, you know, branch out into household cleaners of all kinds. So laundry detergents, household cleaners like dish soaps and all-purpose cleaners, things like that.
Talk about the kind of things that keep you both up at night when it comes to running this company.
Everything.
Yeah, I was going to say, where do you actually start? You know, everything down from the logistics, because I handle a lot of that, and are the orders arriving on time and making sure you're tracking things. And, you know, you want to keep your customers happy, not just at the, you know, the shelf level, but, you know, the larger store chains themselves. You want to be a consistent brand. And, you know, even things like, are people going to like the design of this? Is it going to get their attention? You know, did we put enough like coupons out this month? I mean, and it can be even silly things, but it all plays into it. And you just want to do the best you can every day, because we have, as Ali said, created a really loyal following. And I think we have some of the best customers. I mean, we get customers calling to compliment the products, which makes us feel so good. We've gotten handwritten letters before, which I save for bad days, because you look at that and, okay, we did something awesome.
What do people say in these letters?
You know, I mean, even something like the glass spray. Like, I got a letter from a woman that said it worked great and she loved the smell and she's so happy that she had found something that she really liked. You know, we had another customer where it was her sister's birthday, she was explaining, and she was having a little difficulty trying to navigate the website. So we, you know, sent her a gift for her sister with a handwritten note, and she sent back a really lovely letter just complimenting the customer service and how passionate we were, you know, about you know, our products in the natural cleaning field. So things like that. So you want to make sure you're always doing the best for your customers all the time to keep them happy. And it's a source of pride for us, I think.
Allie, what keeps you up at night?
Well, it's one of those things where you don't really think about it when you're a customer. How many bottles should we order this month? How many labels? What's every single word on every single label that we have for 44 different SKUs at any given time? Where is it coming from? Is the truck on time? What about the sprayers, the caps, everything? So there's all these little things that go into making something. And every single one of those things keep us up at night. And it's not just me. We have a team, a really great team, and all of us, you know, are part of this collaborative effort. But we all know exactly what's going on at any given time. It's in our head. It's in, not only on spreadsheets. So it's a lot to think about.
How do you learn about what goes onto a label?
You know, it was a process. And we did a lot of research before we got started. Not everything actually has to go on a label. And along with customer service, which is, you know, one of the things I think we can offer our customers, which is just really amazing. We love getting to know them, is transparency. Transparency to us is really important. And there's not a lot of requirements right now on packaging for consumer products, and really even on some foods. So we want to take that extra step. We always go the extra step in making sure that all of our products are listed, even when it's not required.
What about marketing? There was a time that to get into this field, I'm sure you needed to be able to have an ad budget that allowed for TV commercials. That's obviously in the internet age, not something that you need to be able to do. But at the same time, you know, it probably can't be word of mouth alone.
No, social media is really important right now, and it really suits our demographic. We have somebody in the office who we had just brought on who's terrific, and she's really helpful with Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and all those things. We're just a little older. We're just catching up too, but she's amazing. And without that, it is a lot harder to get that recognition out there.
You started this company. You and Melina started this company. That's two people. How much have you grown in 9 years?
Well, there's about 12 of us now who are pretty much full time. And my dad retired a couple years ago after 43 years of practicing law. So I'm so lucky he's down the hall and he can always give us some really wise input. So there's about 13 of us, and it's a really great team. And really every day we're grateful for the team that we've assembled.
And the stuff actually gets made here?
Most of it is made here. Most of it's made here. And we work with some amazing manufacturers. Like I said, the chemists here are unbelievable. There's really almost everything you need is right here in Milwaukee.
Where are you finding your customers?
Well, actually, most of our customers are in the East and the West Coast. We're really, really, really grateful for the local support we've had. If not for the local support we had in Milwaukee, we never would have been able to become a national brand. So Milwaukee is just so essential to us for that reason. But yeah, most of our business is on the coast.
What were you doing before you started this company?
Well, I was a divorce lawyer. So I worked a lot with kids who are going through divorce and transitions and things like that. My primary job actually was a mediator and arbitrator for families who are going through divorce. So it's just basic problem solving. It's caring for kids and families. So this is basically an extension of that. I'm just able to express a little bit more creativity in this capacity.
Right. I was going to ask what you brought from that career that informs how you do this work.
I think, and I went to Marquette here in Milwaukee too, which I have to say I was really, really happy with.
A little plug for the alma mater there.
Oh, just loved it. It was wonderful. But I think it was the attention to detail that I learned there, which is important. It's also, you know, you got to take things step by step. You can't just jump into any business and just throw things at it and expect that it's going to go well. You just really have to plan things out and be strategic about how you're going to solve problems. I think that's really important. And the other thing that, like we said, I think one of the other things that's most important about our brand is the transparency. I think if you always tell the truth in your packaging, you're never going to get into trouble. Your customers deserve to know what they're buying. And I think the legal profession really supports that as well.
So talk a little bit about the name. Why was Rebel Green the image you wanted to go with?
We really struggled with it. We really wanted to come out with something that was relevant, that was interesting. And at the time, this was in, 2008, we would walk some of the natural food store shelves and notice that some of these amazing brands just did not packaged, you know, they were just not packaged well. But they could be. And if they were packaged great, they would just sell so much better. So I always use the example of like Kashi and like Frosted Flakes. Frosted Flakes looks awesome. Kashi at the time, you know, now, you know, their packaging is wonderful. But at the time, it didn't have that same appeal as like Frosted Flakes. So we thought, well, why don't we kind of rebel against that conventional thinking that you have to have a natural brand look like something that you made at home. Why? There's no reason for it. Good taste isn't any more expensive. So let's make this amazing packaging to reflect the incredible ingredients that are in there, which are natural.
So am I saying it wrong? Is it Rebel Green?
It's Rebel Green.
Do you worry at all about, and maybe this is down the road, but do you worry about growing too fast?
I think that we are, of course, that would be a worry. I think we're pretty strategic in what we actually can do also. We're really pretty reasonable about not stretching ourselves too thin. So if we have any new products coming down the line, we'll make sure that we have a year or two before we introduce them, and we want to make sure that what we have is doing well.
I'm not a business owner, but it seems like, you know, having 12 people working is a nice kind of comfortable, you know everyone, you know what's going on, you have a good handle on where the business is and where it's going. It might be a little different if there were 150 people.
I think so. And I don't think we'd be happy with that either. I think we feel like a family. You know, most people who work full time spend more time working than they do, you know, at home or even awake. So it's a really nice place for us to work. And I think quality of life is really important. The quality of the lives of all of us are really important. So we always take that into consideration.
Can you give us a glimpse into the future? Are there products that are coming down the line that we should know about?
Well, they'll probably be bamboo because right now we have a line that we just launched, which actually was my dad's idea. He really was excited about this. It's a tree-free line of toilet paper, toilet tissue, and paper towels. And we're so excited about it. So it's a renewable resource. People are just starting to get into replacing paper with bamboo because it just grows. You know, you can actually hear it growing in some fields. So, and you know, a tree takes, you know, 30, 40 years to grow. So whatever we do, I think we're going to want to make sure it's sustainable.
You're not growing bamboo in Milwaukee yet, though.
No. No, but it is interesting, actually. It's one of the things, it's the only thing I think we make outside of the United States because you can't grow it here. And so we do import it from China. And because we have to do that, it's weird. We always had this made in the USA, you know, feel for our business. And it was important to us because of logistics. We don't want a lot of environmental waste on transportation. So because we import our tree-free line from China, we buy carbon credits so that we are one of the only carbon neutral household cleaning brands out there, especially with the tree-free line. So with those carbon credits, we commissioned a study with Yale University graduate students specifically for Rebel Green, and they told us, you know, what our carbon output was. So we buy these carbon credits so that we can buy clean cook stoves for people in Africa and Indonesia.
Do you think are your customers willing to pay more knowing that the you know, for example, their cost is going into carbon credits, or you know, the products that they're buying are made in the U.S.?
I think that's a great question. One of the other things that's really important to us, in addition to, you know, our packaging and our transparency, is price, because one of the only ways you're going to be able to take a conventional shopper, and there's 97% of the people out there are conventional shoppers, the only way you're going to be able to move them into buying a natural product is through price too. You don't want them to have to pay more to buy something that's better for them. So we try as hard as we can to keep our pricing as close to conventional as we can. Our tree-free toilet paper, for example, is pretty close to premium toilet paper brand that's in every grocery store. So we also almost think like it's our mission to, you know, to make natural products accessible to people, not just if you have more money to afford them, but to anybody who's grocery shopping.
Well, Ali Florsheim and Christina Nosbisch, thank you both so much, and best of luck in your work.
Thank you so much for having us.
Ali Florsheim is co-founder and co-owner, and Christina Nosbisch is director of operations for the Milwaukee-based company Rebel Green. You can find a link to more about the company and their products at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break, and then the Irish indie rock band Brave Giant joins us in the studio for conversation and tunes. Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
2 years have gone by now. They went so fast, but yet I can recall when I saw you last.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Of all the ethnic festivals that take place in Milwaukee over the summer, one of the best for music is Irish Fest. And one of the best reasons to go to Irish Fest is to get introduced to bands you didn't know about before they traveled here.
Ireland's Brave Giants started out as a cover band in Longford, Ireland in 2011. Then they started writing their own songs and last year released their Lordy Lordy EP. They've built up quite a following in Ireland, but they hadn't played in the U.S. before performing here in Irish Fest this past August. We got them in the studio ahead of those particular gigs. Here is Brave Giant with More Beast Than Beauty.
Sleeping and my thoughts race round and round. She walks inside my mind but doesn't make a sound. She is more beast than beauty inside her bones. Her heart is buried under a mountain.
Brave Giant in Lake Effect's performance studio. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks
More
so much
Beast
for
Than
us.
Beauty. Wow. But More Beauty Than Beast, actually, I have to say, the sound. The sound is just fantastic. And it's such a pleasure to have you here today.
Pleasure to be here. Our first American radio station.
Yeah, oh, I hope delighted. I hope we do justice.
We do justice for it.
Let's go around and introduce yourselves to our audience and what you play. And Ross, we'll start with you.
Yep. Okay, so I'm Ross, and I play the banjo and the mandolin.
Okay, and do some singing.
Do oohs and ahs in the background.
Okay.
I'm Emmett, and I play the drums. And like Ross, I do some oohs and ahs also.
You were doing some harmony singing
a
there.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and Mark?
I'm Mark. I'm split lead with Pudge, and I play bass and guitar and stuff like that. So
okay.
Do a bit of dancing down tomorrow.
But not in here. We don't need
not
to
today,
do
not
yeah,
today.
Not yet. It's a little early for that. Yeah.
I'm Pudge. I play the guitar, and like Mark, I lead vocals as well. And storyteller.
You guys have been together as at least a duo since 2011, right?
That was when
myself and Pudge started off. We started off under the name Dutch Courage. And we just started playing bars at back home and kind of got pretty well known at that. And then we were starting to write our own stuff, and then we got Ross on board, the banjo player, mandolin, and we really took it, I suppose, seriously then, and started doing a bit of recording. We got Emmett then, the drummer, and the four-piece, we're a Brave Giant now, probably about two and a half years.
Yeah.
And it's back home, it's really kind of taken off the last year and a half, or last year, sorry, it's taken off a bit for us at home, so we're delighted to make it over to the States, though. That's really
and this is your not just your first radio here,
yeah,
but
exactly.
It's also
our debut performance, everything over in the States, so.
And that's fantastic.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved about your music when I first saw you were coming and I was deciding what bands I wanted to bring in, and I was listening to your stuff and I thought, I really love the songwriting part of it. The musicianship is wonderful, but I really love the fact that you are writing your own stuff and that it has something to say. It's not just like, oh, it's a pop song. There's actually things going on. And so what's your process like when you write new tunes?
When we write a new one, It's a collaborative effort or whatever. Generally, it's myself or Ross or Mark that come. We'll sit in our own room, write about our own stuff, then bring that to the lads, see what they have to add to it. Like as regards our own sort of musical influences, we have four very different musical influences. But once we all bring that little bit of the puzzle together, it's very interesting to see what is born out of that.
So what are the influences, each of you?
Well, my own ones, I would have kind of grown up as a teenager, I would have loved UK indie music, and towards the end of my teens, I started to listen to a bit of folk, so the likes of Mumford & Sons and Arctic Monkeys would be two of my favourite bands, both completely different, but both bands I love, like the rest of you then.
Yeah, well, growing up, a bit of indie, but I suppose I would have been... I don't know, I kind of look back and I was like, oh God, why did I really listen to that when I was younger? my influences have definitely grown. I suppose now I love to listen blues, jazz, pop, indie, folk. Loving folk at the minute. Just I go through phases too of listening to different kind of genres. But I suppose as a songwriter, probably folk would be up there. Folk, indie would probably be my big influence.
For me, I just grew up listening to grunge, like Pearl Jam, Nirvana. the Melvins, all bands like this. But I listen to absolutely anything. Depends on my humour, the humour I'm in. I listen to like industrial techno and stuff like that as well. Jazz fusion, anything. If as long as I feel it's honest, I listen to it, you know, kind of. So
yeah. Whereas I'm my ears are very naive. I just grew up with trad as a child, and then Mumford and Sons kind of changed it, and then I went my own sort of way with the banjo. But yeah, pop. Really, I only listen to what's on the radio. But now I suppose this last year I've kind of broadened my
spectrum.
We got him into a dark room and bedded him up until he just started listening to other stuff.
Made him listen to jazz fusion.
Listen to her.
He seems okay. Is he all right? Yeah.
The scars and bruises.
The scars aren't too bad.
Bruises
yeah.
have subsided.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing me.
Well, you are actually probably playing the most traditional set of instruments for this. And again, that's another thing that I really like, the way you guys have all incorporated sort of the trad stuff, but it's really not trad at all.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, that's, I suppose when you listen to our songs, you can tell the different influences of different songs. Like, some songs are very folk, some songs are maybe rocky, but the one common theme is I suppose, Ross with the banjo mandolin. And we're very lucky to have him because he just kind of.
I think that's a good. Like, I was very trad when I was younger, but Podgemed on a different radio station told the story. I actually got kicked out with the Fla. 1 year for going off the wall. I was playing in a guitar and I was playing an accompaniment, but I ended up playing the tune and putting in loads of stuff that shouldn't have been in it, and I actually got kicked out with a Fla. But the point being is that I don't, like, although I came from a trad background, I like to just do my own thing, and Mumford and Sons kind of, that was the start of that.
Yeah,
when I seen a banjo kind of in the limelight in such a mainstream I was like, okay, I can do what I want with it.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, here we have banjo has been put out, like with Bela Fleck and people like that, who are doing jazz on the banjo, who are doing fusion and crazy wild things. And so maybe here we're a little more used to it.
Yeah.
But if you get kicked out of the Fla and you're actually here at Irish Fest, that's pretty good.
Yeah. They actually have
that story.
They have his poster on the wall at the Fla. Yeah. Yeah. Don't let this man within 10 miles of here.
It's got the big circle with the
showing darts. Yeah.
Burning effigies.
I was only like 14.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that I think this festival does so well is brings together all of the music of Ireland. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one part of it, and it's an important part.
Yeah.
But so many people have taken it beyond that.
And
I think it doesn't do the Irish music scene credit to say, well, this is the only thing
that you
export.
That's the thing about trad and Celtic music. Like, there is so many branches to the tree. You can go down a poppy route.
It's the root.
I mean, you have heavy rock bands like Dropkick Murphys and Flogging Molly and bands like this going in another direction as well. And then, as you say, you have like guys playing jazz fusion and banjos. Like, the thing about traditional Irish music, I think just... I don't know.
It's the base of so many other genres.
Yeah, it can influence so many other genres.
Well, I want to hear some more.
Okay.
No, that's it.
That's it. Okay, sorry. Yeah, no more. We've talked. That's it. So which tune are you going to do? I know we're going to hear one that's kind of a mashup a bit later, but what is the tune we're going to hear now?
This one was the first song we released back home, and I suppose here as well. It's called Lordy Lordy.
I wanna be far, far, far away from here. 'Cause I don't think I could take it for another year. Won't you give me some direction towards the light? 'Cause I don't think I could take another sleepless night. So take my hand and come with me, and I'll show you places that we were never meant to see. Yeah, you get your rifle, now I get my gun. Lordy, Lordy, hallelujah, yeah, I think I've found the one. I wanna go where the lights are saying my name. Wasted talent just like mine is such a crying shame. And I hate to say I told you so, but you know I'm right. So go and tell your daddy you won't be coming home tonight. Yeah, so take my hand and come with me. I'll show you the places that we were never meant to see. Yeah, you get your rifle and I'll get my gun. Lordy, Lordy, hallelujah, yeah, I think I've found the one. Just as long as I'm with you, you'll still be thinking of me even once we're through. Then I'll pick up my rifle and you'll pick up your gun, and we'll both shout hallelujah, yeah, 'cause we know that we're the ones.
Brave Giant in Lake Effects Performance Studio, Lordy, Lordy. Lordy, Lordy, indeed. That is a great tune.
Thank you.
That really is. And I know you guys have played it a lot in Ireland, and you're probably kind of sick of it a little bit, but I think this is going to hit here.
Thank you. Brilliant.
You know,
it might kind of rejuvenate if you play it to new audience. It's going to lift us again. You'll get that kind of instant response. So.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, well, that's one of the things. As a band builds up a catalog, people want to hear the stuff that they know. Yeah. And I mean, how do you handle that when it's like, oh my God, do I have to play that song one more time?
No, like it at the beginning when we started to do our own stuff at gigs, like we were still a cover band essentially, but once we started to write our own stuff, we started to kind of filter it out there and just see what kind of reaction it got. And initially, Lordy Lordy, you know, people were, you kind of look down to the crowd and people would be bopping away to it and all that, but eventually people started asking you, will you play Lordy Lordy, will you play this? And that immediately grew our, I suppose,
interest for the song.
For the song and interest to write more stuff. But like instantly now when we do that at gigs and come towards the end of the gig, you look forward to doing that now at your own original gigs, because you look down and people are shouting it back at you.
And going mental. And,
it's very heartwarming to see that. And like Emmett was saying, it rejuvenates your interest in that song.
Yeah, before we came over, we played at one of the Irish festivals, Longitude, and big, absolutely massive stage, massive arena, and there was hundreds upon people there, and they just went ballistic for that song. So like seeing that after, like that's, we released that what two years ago, and seeing all these fresh faces like singing the song word back to us nearly the entire song, it was really, yeah, it was great.
I imagine that that's the thing that keeps all bands going.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
where it's like people just love your music, and that kind of heartfelt give back comes. Yeah. You know, it's what the live performance should do.
Yeah, you go through stages where, probably at the end of the summer, like it's been hectic for us, but coming up to summer, you can't wait to get out to festivals and all that to actually do the live shows, and then you kind of get a little bit tired of that and you look forward to recording more stuff, but the recording is very, very tedious, so once you're done there, you can't wait to get back out to live gigs again.
Sure,
so
yeah.
It's a cycle, but you're just recording more music so you can do more live gigs and all that. So it's definitely live shows is what I enjoy most, because you're literally feeding off that energy of a crowd, of a good crowd. There's no better buzz, I don't think, as a performer or an entertainer. It's brilliant.
So that's, you're doing this full time now? Is this a full time gig?
No,
everybody's
all,
got
all,
a job.
No. Yeah. We're all, I'm myself and Ross are secondary school teachers. So that's why we have to head back actually to school is starting in a few weeks. So God help the kids on the first day.
And what do you two do for?
I'm actually going back to college to do a master's in secondary school teaching in September. So it's gonna be hectic and quite strenuous, but you know, got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And I work for a mobile phone company back home, so hopefully we can get to the point where we can do it professionally. Like, but we balance at the minute, it's fine.
Don't get it. Like, we have strongly considered about packing in the day jobs and not going back to college and stuff like this. Because at times, like, it's hard to keep that creativity flow going all the time when you have maybe 8 hours a day where your mind has to be doing something else. And then the evening time you get home, maybe you're tired and it's hard to, keep yourself going and stuff like that. Even just like organizing for gigs and if we like just more time in studio and stuff like that, we feel like we could do a lot more. But then we're saying it's not really broken at the minute, so let's just keep things the way they are right now. Yeah. So
is the hope that you will be able to pack in the day jobs?
Yeah, that's our hope. Yeah, so we've a lot of things in the pipeline that we're looking very forward to. As I said, like the last 6 months have been very good to us. Like, we've got a lot of national radio airplay. We've becoming pretty well known nationally. TV appearance, stuff like that. And then before Christmas, we're doing a little intimate Irish tour. We've got a big headline show in Dublin in December. Releasing another EP and then looking towards our debut album just before summer next year. So yeah, we're like, as I said, we're still working
away.
Yeah,
that's all.
But, and then there's the day jobs.
And the day jobs. Yeah, but look, we're juggling everything.
I think the busier we are, the more productive we are.
If we didn't have the day jobs, then we'd have nothing else to do for the rest of the week.
I think with the day jobs, you appreciate what we're doing right now more as well. You know, it's.
No, it is always a balance. It's always a balance. Yeah. Well, I certainly hope that you're able to voluntarily give up the day jobs when the time is right to do that. I want to hear the new EP. I'm looking forward to the album. I hope you will send them my way. Gentlemen, welcome to the United States. Welcome to Milwaukee. And so tell me what we're going to go out with. We had a couple of things, a choice. So.
Yeah, we're going to go with the mashup, are we?
Yeah, I suppose.
There's a mashup we released. It's a Daft Punk / Bob Marley mashup that we've done. We actually did it for Valentine's Day a year and a half ago. And it went absolutely crazy back home. It
brought us to the light a little bit back home.
Yeah.
We had some level of success. We had been on national radio and stuff before, but this just exploded well beyond our imagination. And ended up winning €1,000 out of it as well.
Even better. So, Brave Giant, again, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us. Really
appreciate it. What is the name of the tune we're going to hear?
Is this Digital Love mashup?
I want to love you and treat you right. I want to love you every day and every night. We'll be together with a roof right over our head.
Ireland's Brave Giant take us out today with their mashup, Is This Digital Love? The band is Podge Gill, Mark Prunty, Ross McNerney, and Emmett Collum, and they joined us in the studio in August. Jason Reavy engineered our in-studio performance. And that is the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.
I gotta know now. Last night I had a dream about you. In this dream, I'm dancing right beside you. And it looked like everyone was having fun.